BC Annual Bonham Carter Lecture, which I'm going to chair, and I'm also going to introduce today's speaker. I am, for those of you who don't know me, Nelida Fuccaro, and I'm part of the BC Council, and I work at SOAS. Let me introduce our speaker. Well, we are very fortunate to have this evening Dr. Cecilia Pieri, who's going to show us Baghdad over one century. And I must say, I am actually really, really happy to have her here, because she has managed, with her constant, relentless, and very dedicated work, to actually document in photographs Baghdad's architecture, both contemporary Baghdad but also historical Baghdad. And as you can see from the title of today's lecture, Rethinking Baghdad's Built Identity and Strategies, 1915-2015, she will actually get us through one century of urban history of Baghdad. So this is, to me at least, as an urban historian, this is an extraordinary experience. Now, Cecilia is associate researcher at the French Institute of the Near East in Beirut, where she was formerly the head of the Urban Observatory between 2011 and 2015, after spending 25 years as a senior editor in the field of architecture and heritage. She received her PhD in Paris on the subject of the modernization of Baghdad, where she has been conducting fieldwork since 2003, so a really long-standing association with the city, where actually you didn't have many researchers present in a period where you didn't have many people. Many researchers there. Of course, she's extensively published on Baghdad in the 20th century. Her first book called Baghdad Arts Deco was published in 2008 in French, and then it was translated in Arabic and into English, published by American University of Cairo Press in 2011. Now, she has also co-authored a second monograph with Mina Marefat. And this is a monograph dealing with Baghdad again and with Le Corbusier's gymnasium. And also it has been published in three languages. Now, a last book in French is basically also on Baghdad, and it's called Baghdad, the Making of a Modern Capital, 1914-1960. And as I understand, it's based on her PhD work. Cecilia is working on cities in conflict. She's very interested in heritage and the use of heritage as a social and identity marker. And she's been basically the coordinator, while she was working at the French Institute in Beirut, of a research program basically called Heritage at War in the Mediterranean Region. So there is this theme of city and war that obviously, as we know, is very relevant to Baghdad. She also collaborates with UNESCO and as a World Heritage expert, and her focus is obviously on Iraq and more broadly the Arab world. And currently, she is visiting professor at the Lebanese Academy of Fine Arts in Beirut, where she teaches the history of modern architecture. To you, Cecilia.
Thank you, dear Nelida, for this wonderful presentation. I'm very happy and very honored to be here today. Can you hear me? It's a great honor to be invited at the British Academy and to the BC. So thank you very much for inviting me. And I have many friends in this room. It is a great pleasure to see you all. And I'm trying to do my best to not to be too depressing, because Rethinking Baghdad's Built Identity and Strategies to this very day has not only wonderful aspects, as you can imagine. Is it possible to have a little bit less light? Or
you mean the light?
No? Well, yes, it's better. Okay, thank you. So for a researcher, a modest researcher as I am on modern Baghdad, it's a big problem to face this city. It's a kind of challenge because Baghdad is a literary trope. And John Koenig was writing in the 80s that Baghdad is an object of desire, but also a cause of disappointment because it carries the burden of the image forever vanished of the Caliph city. And this grand past of this mythical image has been masking the real modern city, which is never seen for what it is, but fantasized for what it could be in terms of what it was and is no longer. For instance, if you see these books, they are contemporary and they are speaking about modern Baghdad of 1914 and 1929. Yet, it is the image of the Caliph city. And the same for this kind of image. Here we have an image of the beginning of the First World War. It is a very strange image because you have the British flag, you have a soldier which could be an Ottoman one, and a landscape which is, in fact, it's concentrating real details, but the overall landscape is not exactly real. So you have real details, such as on the right. You have also real details, the Guffa on the river. But in fact, the background is a mix between the Mustansiriya University and Kazimiya, who has nothing to do in that neighborhood. So because is it as the image needs to concentrate the magic of the Caliph city. And the same for this kind of image. On the left, you have a map of 1919, which clearly shows that Baghdad was for the British in 1999, was to be a military base. The pink zones are for military and the blue for the civil. So it is clear that it was a military enterprise. And yet, in 1941, when Somerset Maugham crosses the Jordanian desert to arrive at Baghdad and solve the problem of the coup by Rashid Geilani, he writes a book which is absolutely a military the discourse of the military campaign, and the title is The Golden Carpet. So once again, this mythicity is really nourishing all kind of discourses, even those who had nothing to do with the subject. Another image, another burden is also blurring the reality of the city is since 2003. See, I would say since 1991, but particularly since 2003, the images of destruction, which are masking the real city, whatever it is. And especially because all these kind of images, positive but not real, and negative, and unfortunately real, there is a lack of consideration and thus of effective vision, which denies any specific identity to the existing modern territory. This one. So given that, generally speaking, the concept of westernization is embedded in the concept of modernization, and even to a certain extent to modernity, the question is to know if Baghdad could become modern, that is to say westernized, and lose objectively its Oriental, Arab, and Iraqi quality without, for all that, losing its identity. So I got to try to define the ways and the limits within which architecture and urban space in Baghdad have been practiced and used by different narratives British and Iraqis. So such as was true of archaeology, the management of urban space and the manipulation of architectural images before contributing to the affirmation of the Iraqi nation's sovereignty, independence, identity have been contributing since the late Ottoman era to a European interest in the land and to the British delineation of the country. And because architects, although they are apolitical experts, they must be seen like the missionary, the diplomats, civil servants, or politicians as agents of the empire, and especially during the British mandate. So the first phase I will describe and try to analyze, I called it Anglo-Iraqi culturalism. I'm not very happy with the title, but it's a way of describing the fact that culturalism tries to define and analyze phenomena or fieldwork in cultural terms. So in this section, I will try to show how this matches with the contradictory statements said by the British themselves about this Anglo-Iraqi production. Was it Arab Renaissance? As was saying Wilson, was it new Delhification, as we say in the press, or was it the simplest type of building, as we can see in the official documents? So what was the new Delhification? So unfortunately, we don't have any images or drawings of the project, but it was a plan for a new Baghdad, 10 miles long, which would have startled even Harun al-Rashid, which were prepared by Sir Arnold Wilson, the acting civil commissioner. So the young man who studied the Lutyens scheme for New Delhi and decided to eclipse it while the money held out. It is as well the British taxpayer heard little or nothing of this scheme. He would have died from shock. Miles of modern official residences, public buildings, bungalows, churches, schools, parks, boulevards, and business houses were to cover the desert between old Baghdad and the river Diyala. So the picture of this fulfilled dream, which was prepared by one of the Wilson architects, is very beautiful. Fortunately, the strong arm of economy smothered the grandiose scheme in time. So this was planned. So it means that some British had really a plan for a grand new Baghdad, a grand modern Baghdad. And in a way, probably this plan had been drawn because we found here a troubling similarity between the neighborhood of Adamiya and the drawing of New Delhi. Because the drawing, this master plan, had been designed by the same person, which was James Mollison Wilson. I'm going to introduce him. So there is probably, they were the drawings, and they were used later for the design of a new neighborhood. So it's time now to introduce you to a British civil servant, who, compared to Gertrude Bell, is absolutely unknown to the public. Although he literally shaped the public architecture in Iraq in the 20s, and he paved the way to a style which was to last at least two decades in Iraq and then in Iran and in Kuwait. So Wilson was born in 1887. He was not a professional architect. He was not an academic architect. He was trained in architectural firms in England, and then he went to India with Sir Edwin Lutyens, and he was a Lutyens assistant in the master plan of New Delhi in 1912. Then he served as a military officer, and he arrived in Baghdad, according to the file which is in the RIBA, in 1918 as deputy director of the civil works and then director of the public works. He stayed until 1927. And I found in the archives that, in fact, the director of public works was less paid than the chief engineer. So it means that clearly the orientation of architecture was a technical one and not a humanist one. With Wilson, another important architect was Harold Clayford Mason, who was trained with his father, then in Liverpool, then in Rome, then in London. He also served into the British Army in India, and then he came in 1920 at the Public Works in Baghdad, and he was assistant architect of the government, and he was working with Wilson. So he stayed in Iraq until 1935, and then he left Baghdad and he became associate in a private company, which is still existing. And I'm very happy to have here somebody very important for the memory of the British Iraqi, Mr. Bruce Aitken, who is in charge of archives of Wilson and Mason. And he did a fantastic job because all what could be saved of this period is in Wilson and Mason in London. And it's a very fortunate thing, given what happened to the archives in Baghdad. So Wilson was writing in 1921, not about New Delhification, but about Arab Renaissance. And he wrote, "Iraq has been the home of a certain style of architecture, which has influenced the rest of the civilized world. But present circumstances need a new style of building, which it is hoped will integrate the best of its traditional decorative features. It is also intended to use natural building materials available in the country so that what is built may truly evolve as an Arab Renaissance in the art." So in the arts. So clearly the architect has this project of making an Arab Renaissance from Iraq. We will see what kind of, so what was already there in Baghdad when the British came, and that this Wilson discovered, probably guided by Gertrude Bell as a guide. So this kind of old, so this is a very important and beautiful late Ottoman heritage, which still in pretty good shape, even when it's not used. And this is typically the kind of buildings you can find still in Baghdad. So central courtyard madrasas. This one is a school of traditional music. This is the Beit al-Wali, which is very simple architecture, pretty austere, but very refined and delicate, this kind of thing. So you have no colors, only brick and wood, and sometimes a small decoration of ceramics. This is the internal of one of the buildings of the Beit al-Wali, which is very interesting for the kind of columns, very unique, I think. This you know very well, this building, which is the former Iraq Museum, which is not in bad shape, with this beautiful internal courtyard. This is the Kushla, so the headquarters of the government, which was re-articulated by Mithat Pasha. So sometimes you have some ceramics, but it's a very beautiful and very interesting and very solid building. And I show you all these Ottoman buildings because you will see to which extent, in fact, the British took the Ottoman features to readapt them in a new way. They did not invent, in fact. They articulated themselves and their practice on the existing features. This is the Madrasa Markaziya, founded by Mithat Pasha around 1870. So you can see the thick wall, the cross ventilation, ceramic decoration. And this is the facade of the first public university built by Wilson. So there is no great difference between one and the other. So that's why I call that an Arab Renaissance, but a kind of culturalism. So using what is existing to adapt it to a new function. Because, in fact, this university was very modern. Although, from the style, it was prolongating something already existing. For instance, the campus was a modern British one. It was not the central courtyard anymore. You have several buildings here. Several buildings. It was a factory. There was a factory there. And this was also a university for law, for other courses. You have was totally modern for the time. And so from the point of view of the style, clearly it is linked to the Iraqi tradition, because we have there the Castle al-Ashik, which is Samarra, which is one of the icons of the Iraqi architecture. You have this kind of decoration. I don't know the word in English, just décor tapissant in French. The sculpted panels, which are really typically the Iraqi and Islamic tradition. These, for instance, are the details of the Mustansiriya University. But as you can see, the volumes of Al Bayt University are typically Ottoman. So thick wall, cross ventilation, exactly the same kind of arches and of volumes. And when we come to the volumes, we can see that it is totally European. I mean, I don't know if Wilson knew Santa Maria della Pace, but it's clearly a mixed. What I mean is that, in fact, this kind of architecture was very interesting because it was mixing different references in a complete harmony. It was not a problem for them to use Islamic, European, Iraqi, local, vernacular. It was not a problem, and the result is perfectly successful. And coming to the details, these kind of the sash windows, there are sash windows everywhere in Iraq, and the sash windows of the public buildings in the first year of the mandate, British mandate, were all designed here and made here in England and imported or exported to Iraq. So this is the third judgment we can have on this British architecture comes from the Public Works Department, and they say, as regards design, every effort had been made to keep the planning and construction on the most simple lines. Elevation of buildings have been treated as simply as possible, and architectural features and embellishments have been reduced to the minimum. Majority of works having to rely for the effects of simple lines, general massing and grouping, and good proportions. It's really something which is describing what Wilson did. And they continue. This had the result of improving gradually the standards of the buildings without perhaps as much advance in actual architectural design as might have been hoped for. So it is not innovative, it's not super modern, but it is felt that the simplest type of building, plainly but well finished, is the type of structure at which to aim at present. And the object in view has been not so much to consider the effect of the actual completion as the appearance of after the lapse of a few years. And I think it is absolutely describing what Wilson and Mason and the public works directed by the British did in Baghdad and elsewhere in Iraq. For instance, this is the project of 1923 for the Royal Palace, which was not built, so very simple, a cupola, but this is not extraordinary. I mean, it is a classical vocabulary also in the region. The girls' training college, so exactly simple lines, massing and grouping. Simple lines, massing and grouping of this kind of buildings, hospital, hippodrome, and also the Alwiya Club. The Alwiya Club was looted in 2003, but they say it was rebuilt, the facade was rebuilt as it was. So I have to take as it is. This is the Teachers College, 1926-27. And these are Basra and Baghdad airports. This is Baghdad, this is Basra. This is the Mosul station. And this is a project for Basra, probably. So I think that all these kind of buildings are the same kind. And this is a very interesting example of the new British residency, which was built between 1922 and 1928, so exactly during Wilson period. In fact, the grey part was already built, and the green part was an Arab village, which has to be destroyed because it was full of contaminants. It was risking to bring some contaminations to the British embassy. So they destroyed the village. And so this was the existing building, and they built a new one. So I think that even the British embassy was very simple. I mean, it's not a kind of magnificent building. It's very discreet, very traditional. Now we come to the period in which the British were still there, but there were 5-6 years of local eclecticism, which was flourishing in Baghdad. And at that time, Baghdad was extending. So the map shows clearly, this map is 1929, and the map shows clearly the gray parts are the ones which are built. So the British came in 1920, but basically Baghdad began to extend it during the 30s. So on this map, we can see that they built, their priority is to build post-mail, airport stations, police headquarters, bridges, tanks, sports field, but also clubs, all what is necessary for an occupying force to be to communicate with abroad. But the most important is these new neighborhoods. So the new neighborhoods were built along Batawin is one of the first neighborhoods which was built. And what is interesting is that, in fact, in the traditional city, Baghdad was never completely segmented. The quarters were inhabited by people of a sect which was prominent, but it was not completely homogeneous. And in the new neighborhoods, the priority of the new criteria, new social criteria, was the economic ones. And for instance, you can see there into the circle, it is a distance of, I would say, 200 meters, and you have at the same time mosque, churches, and synagogue, especially in Batawin. And I found a text of 1930, who says, though there is a tendency for Jews and Christians to congregate to some extent in their own quarters, there are, in fact, people of all persuasions living in every part of the town. There is no European quarter in the sense the term is used further east, so in India. Although the building of large number of houses in pleasant surroundings near Bab Sharghi is tending to draw Europeans to that end of the city. It is the old story of higher standard of living. All tend to drift into the great urban area where then their sins and their origin can be merged in the general mass. And I think it is very interesting to see, to describe how Baghdad extended in merging in a general mass, despite the diversity of the sects. This is Batawin. This is Batawin when I took the picture, so it was in 2005. And you can see on the general view of the street that it is, we are exactly in the middle between the industrial period, where all the balconies, for instance, are made of the same shape, but all the facades are individual. It means that there is still a communication, individual communication between the client and the ustad, the artisan who builds the house. I'm very sad to show you what it is now. Well, coming back to the hybrid and eclectic architecture of Baghdad, so I'm going to show some mansions which are still in good shape because they were restored in the 80s. Clearly, there are several sources of inspiration along crossed models. I would say there are three or four trends. The first one is the reference to the antique, the Iraqi antiquity, local antique tradition, Mesopotamian. In the large sense of the terms, you have brickwork techniques and glazing, some ornamental motifs, some volumes, such as the central courtyard or the Sassanid style arch. You have also, so this is, for instance, the kind of details of the Iraqi antiquity, and you cannot find it in Syria or in Lebanon, for instance. This is the kind of motifs you have, which are carved in the brick on the facade in Carrara. The second trend is, of course, the Islamic tradition of decoration, which is reintegrated into the modern buildings. So you have details like that. You have also this kind of oriental arches. But the most important is the affluence of neo-Europeans, the European neos in the architecture. This is London. It's not Baghdad. And this is Baghdad. So you can see how much the detail are completely incorporated into very important diversity. For instance, you have this is a kind of Venetian decoration. This is interesting to see how much they mixed details coming from Iraqi antiquity, from Neo-Orientalism, also from stucco, which could be Georgian, and along the principle of themes and variation, because there was also molded cement, so the forms with molded cement could be repeated from one house to another. And this is one of the most beautiful example of stylistic eclecticism in Baghdad. It is a house of 1935. And unfortunately, this is another one. Unfortunately, this is what's happening now. So it is interesting, these photos are interesting because they show exactly what they are doing. In fact, they put a kind of grid in front of the facade in order to install all the tubes and circulations and technical things. And this is what the house is now. Fortunately, I have published it twice, so at least the memory is here. This is a kind of detail you can find in Baghdad everywhere, and I found during my PhD that, in fact, this technique has been invented by the French in 1850. And it's cement tiles, colored cement tiles, and the technique was exported right away to Algeria. From Algeria, it circulated to Morocco and Tunisia. And then after that, when the Europeans came in North Africa, they brought back the technique and they re-imported it to their colonies. So it is a very interesting, very funny story of a technique which is invented somewhere, which travels elsewhere, we come back and circulate it. And it is exactly like the techniques now, for instance. But we can find exactly the same kind of models and I found the same kind of models in Lebanon, in Syria, in Jordan, and even in Europe. These are the beautiful doors in imported teak, and I'm sorry my friend Eli Timan is not here because probably it was his father-in-law who was importing teak. I found in his memoir the fact that he was importing teak starting from 1930. These are the typical wrought iron of Baghdad, and especially typical is this one, which is really, when you walk in the street of Baghdad, which are large and with low silhouette, it is very impressive to see that your visual field is really delimited by this kind of wrought iron. It's very specific because Baghdad is flat, and because of the color of the brick, and because of the atmosphere, and also because I must say, because there is a problem of electricity, the light in Baghdad is very pure nowadays. It will change probably. If we compare to what were doing the Italians at the same time, it was totally different, because Libya and Eritrea and Ethiopia were really a laboratory for modernism. And Italians were building something which was exactly as modern as they were doing in Italy at the same time. But I would say that whether in the case of the British were working in close collaboration with the local artisan, or the Iraqi ustas, the master masons, were in charge of domestic architecture from start to finish, I would say that the domestic architecture in Baghdad made hers transposed, competing in inventiveness and playing with models, found in tradition and in contemporary era. And especially thanks to the brick, the Iraqi master masons invented in their houses something which was a kind of modern calligraphy in three dimensions. Indeed, calligraphy is the art of always creating something different with the same signs. So without seeking to be the avant-garde, as the public work report was mentioning, it was not very advanced, but nevertheless, the Baghdadi eclecticism manifests a great virtuosity in the mechanisms of production of the built work without sacrificing to the teleology of innovation, and I would say to the tyranny of innovation. But we are coming now to the local modern. I chose these 2 years because they are really pivotal years in the history of modern Baghdad. Why? I don't speak about politics today because it would be another lecture, but I mean, it is a very important year because 1932 did not brought the independence, but in the field of urban space, of architecture, it didn't bring anything special. The special things happened after, in 1935, 36, and 37, and 38. It was the new urban regulation, the buildings and road law, the new antiquities law, as you say, you know more than me. 1936 was also the year where Ahmad Mukhtar Ibrahim was the first Iraqi student to graduate in Europe. He began in Beirut, but he finished in Liverpool, 1936. And in 1937, he was appointed as the architect of a government in the Iraqi pavilion of the International Exhibition of Paris, 1937. And in 1938, he became the first Iraqi architect of a government. Because since Wilson, so from 1920 to 1928, all the architects of the governments were British. So the first urban regulation transformed Baghdad and made Baghdad this kind of shape. Very regular. So this photo is dating back to 1939. Very interesting to see how large were the boulevards. And I think, I don't know where it is, I thought it was Sadoun, but it's not Sadoun. I could not recognize the city. So the general prospect of Baghdad is to be a garden city. I put it's garden city like that, but it's not a real social garden city. It has nothing to do with the project, the sole product of the garden city. But it is flat, it is green, and it's full of gardens and full of, I would say, a balance between green spaces and built spaces, void spaces and dense spaces at that time. This is typical orthogonal urban grid, which is still existing. And this is what I call the Baghdadi urban cottage, which is a new idiosyncratic typology. Why do I call it an urban cottage, which is kind of contradiction in itself, because cottage is usually, it's different. But I used, and I stand for it, and I'm going to explain to it, especially to Supri, who is very severe with me. So I call it an urban cottage because it is a suburban habitat at the limit of the vernacular, since it is exclusively produced by local builders using a local material, the brick, and this is an essential attribute of the cottage. The second reason is that it is also a modeled small single-story dwelling in which invention consists in declining a series of variations in the commission without modifying the components, the basic components. Each facade has its own individual decoration, which looks like more or less like the ornate cottages. They are simpler, but it's more or less the same kind of architecture. And in Iraq, in fact, it is the size plus the volumes plus the facades plus the style plus the ornamentation plus the regular suburban implantation of the villa with garden, which to my eyes evoked the aligned ornamented urban cottages. So this is the kind of new urban cottages. This one is in Waziriya. When I took the picture, it was transformed into a wood industry. And it is interesting to see that the Shanashil, the old Musharrabiyye Iraqi in the 30s, has become a kind of bow windows, a British bow windows. So it is interesting to see how a traditional typology is adapted and is still functioning in a new vocabulary, but it is really the still same kind of line. And I put the photo of Made in Britain because we are in 1936 and Britain is still here. And Iraq is really a closed market for the British still in the 30s. So we come now to the end of eclecticism, and this begin in 1935 and 6 after the urban regulation of 1935. And I'm going to show you what the British are still doing at that time, Wilson and Mason and others. This, for instance, is the St. George Memorial Church, inaugurated in 1936, as you can see on the stone on the right. And there, it is interesting to see that they are remodeling references. This one are Cistercian, so Roman architecture, Romanic architecture. And at the same time, they use absolutely the Iraqi technique of bricks and jack arching. So they are mixing European tradition and local Iraqi, and the result is extremely successful. At the same time, this is the Royal Mausoleum built by Cooper, who was the architect of the government in 1936. So these are clearly the kind of references he is mixing. So at the first glance, it is extremely Islamic and traditional, but when you see the detail, you can see that in fact he's taking from Islam, but also this picture is from Peter Behrens in Frankfurt in 1921, completely functional. So when you look from close to this kind of hybridity, it is interesting to see that there is a general harmony, but when you come into the details, it has nothing to do with harmony. And this is interesting in this, this is to my point, what is interesting in this architecture? It is very inventive. And this clearly is the mix between Art Nouveau and Abbasid shape. So we come now to one of the very first really modernist villas in Baghdad, that is the Villa Chadirchi, which was, I would say, it's a kind of local Bauhaus-style house built by Badri Kada, who was a Syrian architect trained in France. He had done two schools of engineer for bridges and technique. And this house has completely abandoned every kind of Islamic or vernacular detail. It is really a modernist house, as you can see here. What is interesting is that when I took this picture from the outside, from the other house, which, by the way, is now destroyed, it is interesting to see that the facade although the vocabulary is modernist, the syntax of the house is really relatively traditional because the facade is not open onto the street. So it keeps the privacy into the house, although the vocabulary is modernist. This is a beautiful example of another architecture of Badrikada. It was the villa of Nuri Said, and it was destroyed last year by the administration of the fine arts, although it was the headquarters of the fine arts administration. I must say that I don't understand why these people destroy these kind of buildings, which were, I visited it in 2003. It was a very spacious, I mean, it could have been restructured, readapted, reconverted, clearly, because it has all the material. Well, it was destroyed. And this is the picture of the first Iraqi architect who graduated to Liverpool. This is the day of his graduation, and probably because he was Iraqi, he was invited to exhibit his. He was taken in picture by the News Chronicle that I had to find in the Liverpool archives of the university. And it is, I think it is very interesting because what he shows is the New Orient. And so his project was a sanatorium for Iraq. He was Kurdish of origin. And the journal, the newspapers, calls it the New Orient. I don't know where is the Orient is here. I don't see any Orientalism in this building, but it is the New Orient. So because, you know, as if people needed absolutely to recall the Orientalism in describing something there. But that cannot be modern. It has to be somewhere linked to the Orient. And this is the new Baghdad. So, for instance, Ahmad Mukhtar, he was an architect. He was not an urban planner. So the first thing he did when he came back to Baghdad was to trace a new street through the urban fabric. It's now Kifa Street. Huh? And this is the new Baghdad, which was built along this red cross. I showed you. Clearly, this is a totally modern style. We are in 1938 to 39, 40. We are making modernist architecture. And clearly, this kind of architecture is, you can find it in North Africa, for instance, especially in Morocco. Morocco is full of these kind of buildings. This is a very interesting building built, designed by Ahmad Mukhtar, Olympic Club. It's still existing, but it is very bad shape. I took the picture, but they are so sad. And this is a very interesting, once again, it is a building which is completely, it is not exactly abandoned, but it is a huge one. It is empty. Only two or three rooms are used. It has enormous gardens because of tennis courts and sports ground for sports, but it is not used, completely abandoned, and probably one of these days it will be destroyed. And the painting here is by Faye Hassan, 1982. This is the kind of house we can find in the late 40s by Sharif Youssef. This one, I never found the architect, but I visited the house. Clearly, it's a completely modern vocabulary at that time. Jafar Allawi, very interesting building, secondary school. So this is the new Baghdad. And at that time, once again, our friends, Wilson and Mason, made, to my eyes, the most beautiful Art Deco building in Baghdad, which is the famous International West Station. But this vocabulary for the time is not modern. It's completely Art Deco. We are in 1950. As you can see, these details are totally Art Deco, and I will show you something which is extremely interesting. These, you see the black openings on the top for ventilation? In fact, they are taking exactly the same shape than the walls of Ninoa, because Wilson was extremely, as you know, very fond of archaeology. Even Gertrude Bell went with him and took him to excavations. And she, there is a letter where she says that she, that he was very interested. And I think this is very remarkable to mix this kind of precise knowledge of Iraqi traditional architecture, Iraqi past, and integrate it into an Art Deco building. And the result is very successful. And I would say that probably for that time, Wilson and Mason could be qualified of being conservative genius. And I use, it is a quote who was used for Lutyens. And because Wilson was assistant of Lutyens, I think that he was also a conservative genius. And this is on the right, the columns of the Beit al-Wali. And you can see they are exactly the same that in the station. So once again, there is an extreme precise attention given to the Iraqi built tradition. So now we come to the roaring 50s with Coates. And I call it the desire of global modernity, because I think that between the desire of modernity and the reality of modernity, there is sometimes a huge gap. Because with the soaring national revenue linked to the oil, of course, and the creation of the Development Board in 1950, the national pride became the dynamics of the nation's activity. And Fadim Kubain, who is an historian of modern Iraq, writes that the rising tide of nationalism and extreme movements determined a radical change in the orientation of the industry, to change it from a symbol of Western superiority into a cooperative enterprise of which the Iraqi could also be proud. And I think this is a very important pivot of the 1950s, because Iraqis began to appropriate themselves to this kind of novelties. And that's the reason why I think that the real independence of Iraq, to my eyes, was not 1932, but 1958, because it was really a definitive change towards what was preceding. So on the one hand, the Baghdad Pact, for instance, in 1955, was an axis against Cairo and Moscow, and the search for international legitimacy incited the government to make the capital a magnet for international investments. And yet, in such a context of displaying international modernism in the urban practice, this modernism appeared in Baghdad as a tool in the narrative, where the reference to Iraq and to the Arab nation increasingly and inexorably became the pivots of a nationalistic discourse. We are going to see some kind of images. So I've studied a lot of official brochures of the 50s, either in Arabic or in English, and they are all extremely interesting because they want to show a modern Iraq. So Iraq, yes, has been the cradle of civilization, but in the 50s, Iraq is modern. And you have the role of women creating a new society. You see mixed universities, which was absolutely impossible 10 years before. And as to the urban practice, clearly Baghdad, so the public work departments had created Baghdad Jadida on the right, but before the very famous interventions of international architects in 1957, before that, Baghdad was beginning to be a metropole and to build hygienist and cooperative housing starting from 1953. Why? Because there was a report, there was an audit of the World Bank in 1950, and their conclusions were published in 1951. And in 1951, they insisted on building new housing and hygienist housing. And that's why, by the way, came to Baghdad the Greek Constantin Doxiadis. And I found many texts explaining that Doxiadis was very well accepted because he was Greek, so he was neither British nor American. But in fact, he was an agent of the World Bank. So with Doxiadis, what came to Iraq was the end of the British and the beginning of the Americans, because all what was built along the report of the World Bank was really built. For instance, this kind of housing is 1953 by Carter Matfai on the left and I don't know who on the right, but it's dated. I say that there was, for instance, Doxiadis was asked to draw the Madinat al-Thawra, the neighborhood which became Madinat al-Thawra in 1956. So before Qasem, and you have on the right a drawing which was made after Doxiadis, because there were so many kuh or sara'if, so shanty towns in Baghdad, inside Baghdad and out of Baghdad, that there was a big need of replacement cities to give these people a decent housing. The picture I took, this one, was taken in 2009, and it is right in the middle of Gardimia. So you can see that sometimes the situation has not very much improved in Baghdad. So this is the kind of new housing which is totally different, which is really a break comparing to the tradition in Baghdad, because it is flat, not because it is flat, because it is hygienist and it is a low-income housing or middle-income housing, because there was a very important role of the cooperative, and the cooperative of the ministries were helping their employees to either to rent or to build or to buy these housing. So modernity became a societal paradigm. For instance, this is a very interesting drawing of the international tender for the Central Bank of Iraq, 1954. So the title of the journal is The Orient Expressed. And the project which won the tender was this one, the lowest, so nothing oriental. So that's why there is a interactive mark with Orient Expressed. At the same time, before the international tenders came, they were the first urban vertical, either coming from British or from the Iraqis. This one is a very interesting building, which it's a kind of modernization of the Musharrabiyyah. You have the mix between concrete and brick, and you have a thick facade of Musharrabiyyah, and probably 1 meter and 1 meter and a half between this facade with holes and the real facade, which recreates ventilation, which makes sunbreakers, which gives space, and at the same time which protects from the view of the street. This is one of the most interesting high buildings finished in 1955 by Abdullah Hassan Kamil and Rifat Shadirchi, the Burj Aboud, and I think that the picture on the right is very interesting because it shows the new city, the Khulafa city, Khulafa Street, sorry, which became the Jumuriya Street after the revolution, and it shows to which extent the urban fabric was cut by these new streets, and how much there was a contrast and a juxtaposition between modern buildings and traditional buildings. So this new tower and the Mirjan building, Mirjan Mosque, sorry. Unfortunately, this is again the state in which this tower is now. So one of the most important architects of that time is Rifat Shadirchi, who built a series of villas for private clients that I would call the Villa Blanche, like Le Corbusier, the white villas, exactly like he. So Rifat had his white period of villas. And I think that some of these villas, and we can see Balkis here, Balkis, who is at the first row. And I think that this one, for instance, is when I teach my students, Miss van der Rohe or Gropius, I show them that. And you know, they are absolutely surprised. Of course, it's 20 years after, but I think that it is a very interesting attempt of mixing modernism and local context. This is another architect, less well known. This is the kind, well, I don't know the name of the architect of these houses, but I think that these houses could have been absolutely, if they were well preserved, it would be very interesting. And now they don't exist. So this is Baghdad at that time, the late 50s. And again, what we are doing, the British, Cooper, the Iraqi parliament. It was very modern. They were AC, they were lifts. But from the style, it is still very, I would say, very classical or neoclassical. So I will pass pretty rapidly on the very famous project because everybody knew what have been done in Baghdad by Frank Lloyd Wright, a project of master plan, opera house, museum, post mail. This project was refused at that time because it was judged too much orientalist because of the statue, which was imitating the Samarra Malouya, and also because the statue was the statue of Harun al-Rashid, who was Persian and not al-Mansur. So, and it was the whole project was oriented toward Mecca. So at that time, it was not fashion. Joe Ponti built this extremely interesting building from the Ministry of Planning commission, and it has been very well restored after being looted in 2003. This is the campus of Baghdad University built by Gropius and the architect collaborative. It is a very interesting campus because it would be too long, too much time to describe it, but it has a series of small, medium, and large courtyards which organize the ventilation and the circulation in a way which is still very functional. So it means that it was very well conceived. The last one was the gymnasium built, designed by Le Corbusier, stopped in 1965 and rebuilt between 1978 and 1980. And this is the beautiful Iraq Museum, designed by Werner Marsch and finished by Jafar Allawi. And so this is really a jewel of the 50s. Fortunately, it was restored properly after the looting in 2003. As you can see, nothing had changed. Even the furniture has been preserved. This was a project which was supposed to be a new gate. Fortunately, there was a real war against this project, and we have now this, which is less worse, but which has some orientalist decoration. They could not prevent themselves to make something which is decorative. So this is Baghdad in the 50s. I will go for a bit faster. And when the Iraqi revolution came, it was the signal of a new, really new era. First of all, because in 1959, the Department of Engineering at the university was created. So it was really a landmark. And in the center of Baghdad, you had now a sort of, in the public urban space, three symbolic monumental statements which were carrying a new iconography as a synthesis between national repertory and a modern one, but it was secular. So this was the arch by Rifat Chatterjee. This is still the Monument of Liberty by Jawad Selim and Rifat Chatterjee. And this is a mosaic fresco of Faik Hassan, which is representing the peace. So as you can say, you can see nothing religious. And this was, in the 60s, this was really the beginning of the first modern Iraqi architectural school, with. Because, and there were three major currents in this modernity tradition debate. The first one is the neo-Islamic Mohammed Makiya, with this kind of buildings. The second one at the opposite is Hisham Munir, international brutalism. And the third main one, is the international regionalism of Rifat Shadici, which takes some traditional Iraqi features and transform it into an international feature. For instance, as you can see that, this house is clearly mixing Iraqi references and other contemporary ones. Another architect was Math Alousi, very interesting also. Less well known, but he did something very beautiful, which is the Baghdad East Station, completely transformed. Kahtan Matfai, who is doing something which is very specific, not especially Iraqi, apart from that house, which is his private house, but nevertheless very interesting also. And Kahtan Aouni, who designed with Polish architects whole campus, which to my eyes is one of the most interesting, probably the most beautiful, interesting example of buildings, with a series of modernizing tradition, which is absolutely unique. And for the time being, it's not ruined, not looted, not transformed, not put with aluminium. This is a detail. These are details of the auditorium. So in the 70s, this is the age of the car. So that everywhere in Baghdad, as in every capital, highways through the city, high-res building, and some other buildings of Kahtan Matfai. But the typical residential built space is still flat and still green. We come now to the period of Saddam Hussein. I will be very brief because, once again, it would be in itself a whole lecture, but I will try to raise the main points. I think that the public architecture under Saddam Hussein can be characterized by monumentality and megalomania. Why? Because, for instance, when I see this kind of buildings, which advertise themselves as musharabize of a new kind, and you see the urban context. It's clear that the urban context has been completely erased to raise these rise buildings. So they can be traditional with the musharabiyye, but at the same time, it is a completely new city which has been designed. At that time, the Iraqi pass was constantly used in the text of the tenders, as they saw them, to gain the acceptance of their projects, even when the reference was not particularly justified. So, and this was real. This was true for the Iraqis or for the foreigners. Again, for instance, the round city is constantly used in new projects. So we have the round city on the top right and the plan of this beautiful monument. I don't deny, it's a beautiful monument, but the plan is imitating the round city. And the plan of the round city is already in this monument. So the reference to the Iraqi past was really a sort recurring motto, even when there was no clear basis for exploiting this heritage. And I show this new monument because it was used to replace this beautiful arch that Saddam Hussein asked Rifat Shadici to destroy. And I think these photos are particularly moving and striking. But the story is continuing. So basically, the quality of the built Baghdad until the 80s, until the embargo, I would say, was still the same. So even if the style was changing, the general prospect and urban harmony was existing. Today, what happens? After years of embargoes and wars and civil wars, or war between civils, two trends. One is under the aegis of the World Bank, once again, to build completely new neighborhoods. Though, for instance, you have here a project for Casimir, which is not done, by the way, because there are too many problems at the municipality of Baghdad. But when you compare to this, this is a Haussmann plot. So I don't think that this has a specific Iraqi quality, because it's totally different comparing to what was in Casimir. Another project, interesting, parametric design, integrated architecture, technology, and ecology with optimal costs. And it will show you what can be an optimum of costs. I don't know what can be an optimal cost in such a project for Baghdad. Again, a project for an eco-city in Baghdad, DNA Architects in Barcelona. Every project is unique, with own personality, own soul, and... the sentence I've just got. And this is the building in London. So which unicity is it? And this is a project for an opera house by a Turkish company. The problem is that while people are designing huge projects for the periphery, the center of Baghdad is atomized and fragmented along cleavages and fences, cleavages mentally, mental and symbolic cleavages and physical fences. You see, you know very well, I don't want to make the story again, but you know that after 2005, mainly because of the de-Baathification and the way it was done and the way it was really implemented, there was a real beginning of the civil war between Sunni and Shia. And the technique was Shia militia and Sunni insurgents were fighting. And because they were fighting into the mixed neighborhoods in order to push the diversity of people to transform them into a homogeneity, a new homogeneity. So these maps on the right shows the difference between 2002 and 2006. Yellow and purple zones were mixed before 2003, and this was left in 2006. D'accord, j'ai presque fini. So these are the kind of walls you can find, checkpoints everywhere. And this, I'm sorry for Camille, but this is the kind of things which happened always in Baghdad. This was a very beautiful villa in 2005. In 2011, beginning of the checkpoint, and since 2012, the villa is blocked by this. You can see how far away, how visible it is from far away. And the red points are the blocked, so in the walls. So it means that, in fact, the whole neighborhood is really blocked by this political party. Everywhere you have territorializing of identity and propaganda. For instance, this was the street of the Chatterjee house. This was a beautiful house, and now it is replaced by this one, which shows the flag on the top of the hub the whole year. Flags everywhere. And before 2007, streets were open, like in a modern city. Now they are blocked. So we are regressing to a pre-modern era. 2 minutes, really. And everywhere, when there are no walls, you have somebody who is guarding the neighborhood. So you cannot enter, as in the pre-modern city, you cannot enter a neighborhood if you are not well known to the people. Everywhere, the neighborhoods are becoming sort of kind of gated communities. And the walls are painted because they are remaining. So, and every time they are changing, they are advocating political messages, for instance, the Iraqi flag. But the major problem is that the fact that the center of Baghdad is totally being neglected, destroyed, void, empty. So most of the houses I took are empty. No efficient heritage protection. Slumification of the city center. We are right in the center of the city. Ruralization of Baghdad everywhere. And this is the aluminium thing. Even in the sectors which should be protected, so I'm finishing with this, that I think that instead of in parallel to building these new neighborhoods, these new Gulfish neighborhoods, I think that there would be two challenges to be really studied. The first one would be to cope with the entangled socio-urban reality of Baghdad Center. Why? Because as you can see here, we have on the same image, on the same around the same square, you have very poor palaces, very poor housing, and at the same time, middle class. So it is interesting to say that, in fact, in the center of Baghdad, finally, people are more reasonable than their politicians because they can coexist. And my hope is that the challenge number two is that the people are fighting exactly the same way in Beirut. They are fighting against the corrupted sectarianism. And this is interesting to see a veiled woman having Madaniye on the right. And I hope that finally this, the fight against the rotten sources of anarchy now in Baghdad will probably prevail one of these days. Hopefully. Thank you very much. Sorry, it was a little bit long.
Okay. Well, thank you very much indeed. I think what we will do is give you the opportunity to ask questions in the reception that we will invite you to in a moment. But before we do that, I'd like to say a few words of thanks for what is an extraordinary survey of the 20th, early 21st century of the architecture of Baghdad. If we started with the idea of a myth of the city, the way in which that was developed and built into the architectural fabric by the British, and then in a way a modern myth was created by perhaps the Iraqis themselves looking forward to the future. And always within that, I could see a thread of extraordinary creativity, which gave Baghdad this extraordinary dynamic and a range, which is very different than anywhere else, I think, in the world. And perhaps that's the point that we can take comfort from, that within that, underlying that, in that great creativity, will overcome current problems. So despite the problems that Iraq has faced and does face, creativity at the end of the day will come to the fore. And I think this wonderful survey, extraordinary overview of the achievements of Baghdad, we thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Thank you.
So please do now join us for the reception outside, and Dr. Berry will be there, I hope, to answer questions.
Yes, thank you. Of course. Thank you very much. Sorry for being a little bit long.
No, it was